Hey, everybody, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are a few things you can do to stay in the loop and help us keep chatter going. Follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Download us wherever you get your podcasts and review us on Apple if you're feeling kindly. Join us on Patreon for great bonus footage from the show, including rapid fire questions with the featured authors, pre and post show chatter, and whatever else we edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com and subscribe to our monthly newsletter. You get a sneak peek at upcoming authors. And if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's an easy way to buy books online and support your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. Most importantly, stay in touch. Send any questions, comments, ideas, insults to info@chatteronbooks.com.
It's Chatter on Books, and if you think this introduction is boring, you try writing the copy. I'm Jamie McIntyre. Here's Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. I was just saying to our gang, we have a terrific show this evening and fabulous people on the show. We'll never have enough time to get to everything I want to get to. But anyhow, in just a little bit, we are going to be speaking to Dennis Lehane, who's just, he's just a rock star in many different categories. And his latest is Small Mercies. So we have a wonderful little Chatter on Books newsletter that we send out sometimes every 3 or 4 weeks, sometimes every couple of months. And the number of people I know who emailed me or texted me when they saw the upcoming schedule and they said, Dennis Lehane, somebody actually called me and says, it's not the Dennis Lehane, is it? But then I panicked because I thought, ooh, what if we booked?
Maybe there's a different Dennis Lehane.
Yeah. Some loser Dennis Lehane from Pittsburgh or something like that.
Right? I was one of the people who like emailed you and I was like, can you please
immediately,
please be on this.
Yeah.
I don't want to be on like anything else. Even when my book comes out, I don't care. I just want to be.
You'll definitely come back. Okay. You're hearing the dulcet tones, people, of everybody who was with us this evening. First up, Lauren Larson, who's taking a small break from her gymnastics training to fill in for Claude this evening. David Aldridge, back from New York, sports town. Ugh. Tope Falerin. This is an all-star crew. Angie Kim and Lou Byard. Welcome, everybody. Welcome back.
Great to see you, Tori.
Good to be back.
Well, Lou, you just heard Lou say it's good to see you, people. It's good to see us for 14 minutes because Lou, months ago, said, yes, I'd love to come on. And I'd like
know,
to come on.
This you're going to shame me. You're going to shame me for public entertainment. You're going to shame
I really think it was 3 months ago, looking ahead to the spring, I thought it would be great to have Lou on because he's so involved with Penn Faulkner, as is Tope Falerin. And he can talk about the Penn Faulkner Awards coming up. He can talk about how Penn Faulkner spends all its time dealing with banned book idiots these days.
Right.
So we book him months in advance, people, because we know since Pale Blue Eye became a movie, Lou's hard to get.
Is that true? I'm not sure that is true.
I haven't had lunch or dinner with you once, Lou. That's right.
Yeah. Oh, no.
See what you opened up. I've been dodging Angie for months, and it all comes out now.
I'm a little colorblind, but I think Lou is wearing blue this evening, so that's good.
I am.
In terms of catching up, we're going to start with Lou because he's just going to ghost us in a few minutes. So Lou, we got to spend a little bit of time talking about the Penn Faulkner Awards coming up and how you and Tope work together. But we've not seen you since you were on the red carpet at the premiere of your wonderful book, which was turned into a movie, Pale Blue Eye, which was fabulous, by the way.
Thank you.
Importantly, I got great photographs of you on the red carpet.
You did. I texted them to you directly.
I shared them immediately. Who were you wearing?
I was wearing Tori. Honestly, it was not a fancy designer. I was wearing some sort of Macy's experience.
It was a good Macy's experience. People, you can Google it. You can just Google.
No, I couldn't afford Tom Ford. But yes, it was lovely. Yes. The red carpet was a blue carpet. So of course we're going all blue as I am tonight. Yeah.
Oh, because of the pale blue eye.
Yeah,
There you go.
We do what we must. So no, it was a lovely experience and I had benefactors who will not be named tonight during that experience. And it was fun. It was a blast. So
good. And will there be more?
Perhaps,
or do we have to wait 12 or 13 years?
Exactly. I think that may be the thing. Yeah. When I think about the Queen's Gambit, Walter Tavis was like dead for 3 decades before that became Yeah.
Oh,
so yeah.
Yeah.
So if it happens long after I'm gone, I'm okay with that. Or else I won't be around to be okay with it or not okay with it.
We'll speak nicely of you. Make sure you get buried
in it. Troy, you're expecting to be around. I love that. You're gonna survive me. Yeah.
Okay. Give us the CNN headlines version of, I'm not sure, Penn Faulkner Awards coming up. Terrific authors in there.
Yes.
And then Tope gets to go next. What's going on with Penn Faulkner? And every day now, my Google feeds, et cetera, are filled with different idiots banning books. So how much of this is a focus for the organization?
Oh, man, I'm going to let Tope deal with the book banning. It's so fun to see him in a non-Penn Faulkner setting because we're usually doing the Zoom screen in this other function. So it's nice to see him and Angie and David. Oh, gosh, this is so sweet. So, we have five finalists. I will start there for the 2023 Penn Faulkner Award. And they are If I Survive You by Jonathan Escoffrey, Fruiting Bodies by Catherine Harlan, The Islands by Dion Irving, The Book of Goose by Yiyun Lee, and Sweet Soft Plenty Rhythm by Laura Worrell. I need to get their names, the pronunciation of their names down at some point before the celebration.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I will say the winner is, and this is a strange thing that we do. We declare the winner a month out, which takes away any suspense about the outcome. This is not going to be an Oscar moment. Mm-hmm. The people coming in, the five finalists know who won the award. But what I love about the Penn Faulkner Award is that it is very much a first among equals. And every author gets the same amount of time to talk about their book. The only difference is that Yiyun Lee, who won for The Book of Goose, is going to go last. But other than that, it's very much a parade of equals. And I actually want to talk to Angie because we both did this on the Edgar Awards. We were both nominated for Edgar Awards and she won. It was very much that Oscar situation where you're sitting there hearing your name called out and la, 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 la. And somebody else's name, in my case, was called out and you're going, oh, great for you. Oh, that's so good. Oh, that's so good. I'm so happy for you. So I've become a student of the loser reactions at all these award shows. How do they, because they know the camera is on them. They know that. So what do you do when somebody else's name is called? Angie doesn't have to worry about that because she won when she was at the
end. Well, okay. So when I won, it was everything was canceled, so I didn't have a thing to go to.
All right, fine.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah,
they didn't even do it virtually.
So what they did was for all the things, you know, like it was very strange because they asked us to record an acceptance.
Oh, right.
Beforehand, right. And you're like, this is so wrong. Oh. Because, you know, it's like tempting fate. You're not supposed to like. You know, you're yeah. right. You're yeah. let alone yeah. record it.
No,
right?
No, never.
Oh, that's terrible.
I've been on both sides of this. I was fortunate enough to win the Kane Prize for African Writing in 2013. And so it's this incredible moment. I was there and we were told that the winner, like the press knew about the winner before the winner knew about the winner. So the press would descend on a table. And I was sitting there nervously eating my whatever I was eating and the press, like, you know, descend on the table. And I was like, yeah, it's incredible. 3 years later, I was shortlisted once again, came in with my swagger thinking, yeah, I'm going to be a two-time winner. I've done this before. and of course, I lost. And I have to say the feeling that like sort of sinks into your stomach is one I had never experienced before. Like it's a shock. It's a combination of shock and unhappiness and a little bit of happiness for the person who won. But self-pity is also a major factor.
Oh, deep self-pity. Absolutely.
Yes. Tope, don't you feel like, didn't you kind of go in like, they're not going to give it to me again because I just won it. Like,
it sounds like Tope did not go in with that feeling. He was feeling good.
Really.
He was feeling good.
No.
I think you feel like confident, like, or the situation like overwhelms you a little bit. So you think, you know, there's a chance. I have a shot.
No, you always think you have a shot. I had a little acceptance speech. Did you have the acceptance speech ready? Did you? What? I had a little tiny acceptance speech, which I still have not yet been able to give because I've not been presented with the word.
Poor baby who have his first debut novel made into a major, major movie with A-list stars. Yeah, like, oh, I feel so bad for you, Lou.
It was my fourth novel, Kim, and not my first as like you. Anyway,
were you going to thank your grade school English teacher or somebody? What was
it? No, screw her. I can't even remember her name, actually, but I was going to thank my dad, who was a West Point alumnus, class of 49. Yeah, I would have definitely thanked him. Yeah,
Very nice. And was totally book banning. Give it to us, man. How's it going? What is Penn Faulkner doing about it? Because I'm not kidding. So I have these different alert feed things set up, right?
Yeah.
And for 3 years now, I've had one set up on essentially all things books in different categories. And it used to be, Lou Byard didn't win the Edgar Award. It used to be kind of newsworthy things about books.
That was the headline.
Byard loses again. And now the feed every day is filled with book banning stories. And we got an email. I won't read it now, but we got an email from a listener who said, please don't use my name, because I'm so embarrassed, but the representatives, House of Representatives in the state of Missouri, big time book banners. I mean, there's so much of it. But Toby, how do we feel about this? What are we going to do?
I'm not sure I can speak from an institutional perspective for Penn Faulkner. We're still getting our arms around it. Obviously, we're incredibly upset about it. I think we're thinking about doing a panel at some point in the near future around it. Personally, it's shocking to me that, not to get too political, but there's certainly one side that says, hey, we're for freedom of speech. We support freedom of speech. It's important. It's incredible. We love it. And then they're turning around and saying, these books are problematic. Let's ban our kids from reading them. I just cannot reconcile those two positions in my mind. I think it speaks to, obviously, this kind of larger cultural battle that's happening. I think there are some people who are desperately afraid that you have a number of sort of younger people who are coming to political consciousness at this point. They've spent their entire childhoods, kind of scrambling under desks for, sort of drills around the potential of a shooter coming into their schools. They're upset about the way that, LGBTQIA folks are being treated. And they've learned a lot of their values from books. And so I think there's one side, one party perhaps is convinced that this is a viable method of ensuring that more people don't come to a kind of consciousness that may prompt them to vote for somebody else. And this is incredibly important to me because my parents are from Nigeria, and my dad's strategy for raising us when I was young was the moment I turned 5, he would drop us off at the library on the weekend. My dad worked 7 days a week. So 8 a.m. on Saturday morning, he would drop us off at the library, and he would tell the librarian in a very stern voice, he would say, my kids should only read biographies of great men. And then he would walk away. And then I would turn to the librarian and say, where's the latest science fiction novel? And, she would wink at me and pull me over to the sci-fi. I learned about everything from books. I was a basketball fanatic. I grew up in Utah. I was obsessed with the jazz. And so I read everything about the jazz. I read about sports. I read about my favorite athlete, Akeem Olajuwon, who was a massive hero of mine. Everything I know came to me via books, and books that weren't necessarily always for, the kinds of books I was meant to read. I read widely. And so I got a greater sense of the world from engaging with literature. I think it's a tragedy that now we're in a political moment when certain people are convinced that younger folks shouldn't have the opportunities that I had, to kind of embrace the world and engage with the world via literature. I think it's truly tragic.
Yeah, I agree completely. And we've talked about it before on the show. So many people, for so many kids, books were the safe place.
Absolutely.
For me, unless, meaningful, traumatic ways. But it was my safe place to get away from my wackadoodle family, with whom David is very familiar. For kids who were trying to figure out their sexuality, books were the safe place. That's where you could go when your parents, God bless them, couldn't talk to you about these things. And Toby, I take your point, but what I worry about is this has gone beyond politics.
This has
gone beyond that. If it was just the Republican Party, I'd go, there's only so much harm they can do, right? It's gone beyond that, and that really worries me.
You're absolutely right. Though there's a cultural battle we're experiencing, and I never thought, growing up, I remember in school, we were told, certain people in history were bad because they burned books. That's something you don't do. America's great because we don't do that. You can go to a library, yeah. You can encounter a perspective that you are opposed to completely, but you might engage with it and learn something about the other side by reading that book and learning what those folks think. And so the fact that we've arrived at a political moment when, yeah, to your point, people from all over the place are saying, you know, kids shouldn't have access to these kinds of books is deeply troubling and deeply problematic.
Yeah.
I saw something the other day that kind of troubled me also on this topic, which is not just book banning as like a theoretical thing, but for certain books that are under fire or whatever, I have seen certain people speak out, you know, authors speaking out on behalf of their own books or whatever. And what's been weird to me, sort of thinking back about it, is seeing them say things that are not general, you know, like we shouldn't be doing this to sort of any books, but them saying, well, my book shouldn't be banned because my book doesn't do this or that. Like my book has addresses this topic, but it doesn't have the F word. Well, does that mean that every book that says fuck, I think we're allowed to say fuck, right?
Absolutely. It's a podcast.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Does that mean that, like, you know, my book, which has that all over the place, so that should be, that's fine to be banned?
Angie.
And like,
you know what I'm saying? The books, Angie, that's what I'll say to you.
What?
Stop cussing in your books is what I'd say to you.
Okay, Lou, you have to go. Bye. Lou's got to go. Angie, to your point, I'm going to try to think of this line. It's this line, like if you're, you know, trying to appease terrorists, it's like feeding the alligator, hoping he eats you last. Hmm. Exactly. I've seen this too. I can't think of names or specific authors, of course, but I have seen this too, where they say, oh no, because what I'm really addressing is X, Y, and Z. So I can't speak to what you're doing with all these other books, but don't do it to me, which is terrible.
I heard a snippet. I don't even know what author it is, saying something about, well, my book does discuss abortion, but my protagonist decides not to have it. So that means that if she had decided to have an abortion, then it should be banned? Like, come on. Like, what is that about? That to me was very disturbing.
That's a really good point. And I'm glad you raised that, Angie. And I think the other side of this, too, is this new kind of move to say that if a book that came out, let's say, 50 years ago includes terms that people might find problematic today, that you go through and kind of edit everything out of the book. I also kind of disagree with that as well. I think I saw somebody say it would be better to contextualize that, right? To say maybe somebody writes an introduction and says, you know, here's the moment where this book was being written. Here's how people thought about these issues. Roald Dahl is someone who comes to mind. I read a bunch of Roald Dahl, and I'm not alone at all, any stretch in that, you know, and I read a bunch of his books, and he certainly said problematic things about all kinds of people. But these are books that millions of people read coming up, millions of people engaged with. Millions of people learned about their childhood, about growing up from those books. And I think it's much better to kind of contextualize the books and to say, you know, here's where he's coming from. Here's why this is problematic today.
David, you have a strong point of view about that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we talked about that last week, right? We talked about that for the last several weeks about the notion of whether it's Mark Twain or Dr. Seuss or whoever it is. Like, you know, you have to.
Yeah.
These things happen. These people wrote in their time. And I think it's actually a good thing, because if you explain to children that Dr. Seuss, while he was wonderful and wrote these incredible books, also had a really, really nasty kind of racism in his early work, you know, it lets people understand that, oh, wait. Racism was everywhere back then? Yeah, it was. You know, and so that's why it's important that we know that, and instead of trying to whitewash it and pretend that it didn't happen.
I think it also teaches people about human nature. Yeah. Just because somebody might be able to write really cute, fun books that you can repeat the lines endlessly doesn't mean they didn't have a bad side to them. And that happens to be human nature.
Yep.
Okay. Oh my God, so many things we're not going to get to because it's 20 after. But I have to, I'm going to read this. This is from a New York Times story. I hope none of you read it. I'm going to read you a couple of lines from a book, and you have to give your honest opinion about the quality of the writing, okay? And we'll go, just to tee you up, we'll go, David.
Sorry, this is really bad. This is
going to No. Like, you won't hurt anybody's feelings. No, you won't hurt anybody's feelings. Okay, here's the line. Quote, The cheese was congealed and the chips soggy, damp and smeared with a greasy film like some kind of lake scum. Gus forced himself to take a bite, but the flavor was rancid, a sticky, sweet imitation of cheese. He washed it down with a swig of beer, but even that tasted ugly, like it had been sitting in the sun for too long. Scale of 0 to 10, 10 being the best, 0 being the worst. Tope, you go first.
Oh, I thought
I switched it.
I'm okay with what I heard. I'd give it a 7.
Okay, Angie?
Yeah.
I'd do something like that. I'd probably do it a 6. I didn't okay. like Yeah.
David?
You give it a 3 because it was ChatGPT, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, you son of a bitch.
Oh, it was. It was ChatGPT.
Okay. It's a topic for longer conversation next time, but it's a book called Death of an Author, which is written by a writer and AI.
Yeah.
ChatGPT and a couple other AIs because one isn't enough. And it's called Death of an Author. And the writer on the book is listed as Aidan Marchine, M-A-R-C-H-I-N-E, which is conflating his last name and machine.
Okay, and so but just today, I sent to several friends a beautiful essay. Tope, have you read this? It was in the Believers a little while ago called Ghosts.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
It's unbelievable by Vahuni Vara, who wrote The Immortal King Rao, which I love. And full disclosure, she is repped by my same agent and agent goes on and on, blah, blah, blah. But still, I mean, this, I just put it in chats. And it's in The Believers, and which used to be part of McSweeney's, maybe still is. And it's called Ghosts. And she wrote an essay that she couldn't ever bring herself to write because it's about the death of her sister, which was too painful for her. And she started writing. So she wrote one sentence, fed it to the AI. It came back with a whole essay. And then the essay was wrong, obviously, because they didn't know anything about her sister.
Sure.
So then she would have to like write little by little. So she basically like kept the first sentence, then added and by the time you get to the end, guys, it is beautiful. And the stuff that it's coming up with based on her voice that it's learning through this interaction is unbelievable.
But that to me is the terrifying thing. Yeah. I don't know how we refer. ChatGPT learns and gets better. So David, do you anticipate in the next 5 years, will you be using, and don't screw around, will you be using something like ChatGPT in your work?
Me?
Yes.
No.
Okay. Angie, can you anticipate using something like this in your writing?
So I was at a conference the other day in Mexico. I was like emceeing this conference. There were like 5 things that I had to introduce. And by the third one, I didn't know this author or whatever. And we had been talking about ChatGPT. So I asked ChatGPT to write me a 2-minute introduction. It fed me this thing full of these quotes and reviews and things that I wouldn't have, been able to come up with. And then I told it to make it funny. And it made it funny. And so I just read it out to the crowd and I told them this was written by ChatGPT. The author loved it. The audience loved it. It was awesome. And I was like, I'm doing this from now on. And now we have Dennis Lehane.
We're going to get all stumbly and we're going to get all nervous. Dennis Lehane, welcome to Chatter on Books.
Hi, how are you?
We're good. How are you?
Good.
Okay, so just by introductions, I don't know how they appear on your screen, Dennis, but that is David Aldridge, Angie Kim, Tope Falerin. Everybody say hi to Dennis Lehane.
Hi, everybody.
Hi to Dennis Lehane.
Dennis, I was telling people a few minutes ago on the show that when we put out a little newsletter every once in a while with the upcoming schedule, sometimes it's accurate, sometimes it's not. And I had so many people text me or email me going, you don't have Dennis Lehane, or do you have like a different Dennis Lehane? Which kind of panics me because I thought, oh, maybe I book some, Dennis Lehane from Pittsburgh. But anyways, we are so glad you're with us. This is terrific to see you and to meet you. And I'm going to try, David and I are going to try hard not to geek out because Angie and Tope are actually really talented, successful writers.
Okay. So
David and I will have stupid questions. And then Angie and Tope will have the smart writer type questions. Okay.
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 So I was one of the people who actually immediately emailed and said, what can I do to be
within
on
this seconds
show so that I can talk to Dennis Lehane?" And also sold to you the point that I had actually literally written an article about how I idolized Dennis Lehane so much that I basically like use reading Mystic River as a master class for myself, because I don't have an MFA, to teach myself how to try to write a good novel.
Wow.
Angie's got a terrific book coming out this fall called Happiness Falls. And so she'll give you some of the money she makes.
Okay.
We set that up.
That down.
Okay, Dennis, our listeners love the backstory on authors. And I've read a lot about you. I've listened to a lot of your interviews. Dorchester, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. 60s and 70s. What mm-hmm. was it like growing up? What did you want to be when you were five? And how much, as kind of a segue to this fabulous book, Small Mercies, did what was going on in Boston at the time, desegregation, busing, et cetera, influence you in particular?
Well, I don't know what the hell I wanted to be at five. At five, I probably wanted to be an alien. I don't know what I wanted to be. Like, who knows what they want at five? I wanted to just ride my big wheel at five. That's what I was all about. Let me think. So when I was nine, South Boston, which was the next neighborhood over, was faced with court-ordered desegregation of the public schools, and it ripped the city apart. And it's a very strange thing to suddenly be walking down a street in an eastern city known for its erudition, if you will,
yeah,
and see KKK spray painted on walls. To see kill all N-words spray painted on walls, and you're nine. And then to see people who, you know, you pass in the street, who wave, smile to you, who seem super sweet, who are in some ways very nice, throwing rocks at school buses with children on them. You don't process that well at nine. Mm-hmm. There's no way you can get your head around that people you love, in some cases, are capable of active hate. You know, it's impossible. It's impossible to grasp that paradox when you're 9 years old. So I think it was something that when I wrote this book, I finally understood an anger that had been in me since I was very young that I could never point to the cause of because it wasn't personal. I had two loving parents. I was never abused. I was, there was no massive trauma that you in my life until I was 16 or 17. And so like none of the things that usually connect to rage made sense. And then when I was writing this book, I said, oh, that's what I'm so pissed off about. That's what I'm so angry about. You took my childhood. You just did it on a national, you was in an amorphous group. You was the group of people who were spray painting that shit on walls. You were the group of people throwing rocks at buses. You were the people making me question everything.
Yeah. I heard the story, or I watched, maybe it was on the CBS piece this weekend. Mm-hmm. Your dad took your kid. I think you're 10 years old.
Yeah, 9 or 10. My dad took a bad turn and he just did not. I think memory doesn't line up completely on the whole event with the horror lines up. But I think what normally we would do is we would hit where Broadway Station is in South Boston if we're coming from the city, and we would take a right to go into Dorchester. We wouldn't go down Broadway. Right. And so my father ended up on Broadway. So that tells me it was probably blocked off. Our way out was probably blocked off. But I don't know. But once he was in there, we're stuck. And we were just buffeted down. Broadway's long, man. Broadway is very long. And so we were buffeted down Broadway through this thing. And I was just looking out at all of it. And it was just the word I always use is medieval. It was like in Frankenstein when they come for the monster. You know what I mean? It's just the pitchforks and all that. That's what it felt like. So I think, it took me a very long journey in my life to get to the point where I could understand through the writing of this book. I couldn't understand why the writing of this book felt so great. I mean, it's a dark book. It's arguably the darkest thing I ever wrote.
Right.
And yet it felt like an exorcism. It felt like an expulsion. And I think that's exactly what it was.
Wow. The book, everybody, is Small Mercies, and we will talk lots about it. So it was therapeutic, though. The writing was therapeutic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So everybody hold that thought. He's this kid growing up in Boston in the 60s and 70s in this medieval experience and starts this fantastic career and moves to California. This is a big jump, but I want to read something. And I hope this was correct, Dennis. It was an article by a guy named Oliver Jones in The Observer talking about you moving to California.
Yeah.
Do you remember this?
No.
Okay, this is great. If you're a hard-boiled East Coast crime writer forced to move west at the insistence of your family and in support of your burgeoning screenwriting career, which you had, do yourself a favor. Don't move north of Montana, Brentwood, or any of those places. Dennis Lehane made that mistake and pretty much lost his marbles. I really hope this quote is accurate because it's spectacular.
Okay. Well,
I just wanted to kill everybody, says the Boston legend. That's you. It was really bad. We were living in this neighborhood where everybody sat in their coffee shops all day in their $1,000 worth of sweaty Bettys and Lululemons and sipped their coffees with their perfect faces and their perfect bodies. And they look like the most unhappy sons of bitches that I have ever seen in my entire life. They are all just pissed off about something.
Yeah.
Sound like you?
Yeah, that was true. Yeah, no, that was, I know exactly where I was then. It was also the follow-up to that quote was I would always say, I was so tired of running into pinched-faced white ladies with purse dogs demanding to speak to the manager.
Yeah, I think actually, that Dennis, was duck lips, women with duck lips and purse dogs. And let's not hold it against the purse dogs because, you know, they just hop in the purse. They have nothing.
Yeah, they do have nothing against it. So, yeah, so that was bad. That was bad. That's bad.
But what made you, you're such a Boston guy. So what made you go, this is it. I got to do it. I got to move out here. And then I've got questions
nothing.
For you.
No, nothing. No, my ex dragged me out here. She thought we should check it out. And then she decided that she didn't like the whole concept of marriage to me. So that was fun. So then I was stuck here and then I had to make the best of it. And I'm very much I'm speak softly and carry a big stick when it comes to this sort of stuff. So I just realized, oh, I'm stuck. I immediately pivoted. I immediately said, I want to be the type of dad my kids always see. So what allows me to do that? Screenplays, TV. Dave, and right around that time, I hooked up with David Kelly. And David and I went out to create Mr. Mercedes together. And I said to him, David, I'll lay everything on the field for you 4 days out of the week, three days out of the week. I got to walk through my door at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And it's not, and if you don't want that, don't hire me. And David, this is why we get along so well, said, no one's ever had a good idea after 3 o'clock.
That's pretty brilliant. Brilliant. Okay, wait, hold that thought for a minute. Toby first, and then Angie, and then David. And David, the geography question doesn't really work for you because you're constantly all over the place. But Toby, how does geography affect your work and your writing, or doesn't it? Because there is such a huge cultural difference, it's a cliche, between Boston and L.A., right? But how does geography off, you know, a lot of that, Toby, is your background and where you're from and where your parents grew up. But how does it impact you and your work?
It impacts it a lot because, yeah, and I grew up in Utah. So there was just a big disconnection between, you know, my family and where they were from and where we were growing up. So much of my writing, at least my earlier writing, explores that sort of divide, what's happening. Yeah. That distance between family and community. And also, like, you know, the fact that I loved my community so much. I love the people that I grew up with. I mean, there were people in my neighborhood who actively looked out for me. I mean, I remember quite vividly my first grade teacher, Mrs. Abel, would pick me up and my brother up every Saturday morning and take us to the museum. She would take us to a bookstore. She was part of the community that, like, sort of raised us. And she knew that my parents were still kind of getting to understand, you know, the place where they had landed. And so, yeah, to have like a kind of visceral connection to certain people and also recognize that so much of the community is in certain ways has an ideology that might not always have space for you and yours is a very interesting kind of thing to try to resolve in your mind.
Yeah.
So it plays a massive role. And then of course, now I live in DC and I didn't think I'd be in DC for more than a couple of years. And so like living in this cosmopolitan city has also been incredibly interesting. Raising children here, you know, their view of the world is completely different from mine. Their view of their own possibilities all of that animates my work in all kinds of ways.
Yeah. Angie?
Definitely, it animates it in so many ways because, you know, I grew up in Korea, you know, and I think it's also the economic foundations of it and the linguistic foundations of it too, you know, and then I come here in middle school, I don't speak English at all. And so that is, you know, to Baltimore. And so that's like a huge thing that, you know, I have to grapple with. And, you know, and in so many other ways too, like I'm in Northern Virginia now and you sort of think, well, I'm basically in DC, but my husband who grew up in a trailer in North Carolina will like refuse to, when I was like, can we live in DC or Bethesda? He was like, absolutely not. He has this rule that there are, that his father taught him, that there are three things that you pick in your marriage to fight about. Only three. And that's it. And you don't
put anything
else. And oh, yeah, bring this.
That's his one and only thing in our, like, what, we've been married for 30 years or something. That's his one and only thing that he has picked to fight about is he will not move to Maryland or D.C. and definitely not San Francisco, which is where I wanted to be. And, you know, so I do think that there's a lot about sort of the economic realities and that informs culture, right? And it informs your community and informs your, you know, the way that you see the world. And I saw that so much in Dennis's work, which is why when I was reading Small Mercies, I knew I was going to Boston this past weekend. I actually saved
it. Book.
I told you guys, I emailed you guys about this. I actually saved it until I was in Boston. And then I read it all this weekend in Boston. And it just like, it just made sense to me. To me, this, you can't separate the place from the story, from the voice, from, you know, your attitude.
Yeah. David, geographical inspiration or not? You could say not.
Well, no, I mean, I live in D.C., so and I've lived here my whole life. So and I live in the city. I don't live on Capitol Hill. There's two parts of D.C. There's the city where the people live. And then there's Capitol Hill where, you know, I didn't want to talk about those people.
Or bad stuff happens. Bad stuff.
But no, of course, where you grow up influences your writing in your life. I grew up in D.C. in the 1980s in the time of Marion Barry. And anybody who never lived in D.C. has an idea of what Marion Barry was like, has a caricature of Marion Barry in their head. Marion Barry gave me my first job. He gave every kid that I know their first job in the D.C. Summer Youth Employment Program and transformed this city to the good. And I have a very different impression of Marion Barry than 99% of the people who don't live in D.C. have a Marion Barry. So, of course, it influences it, just as I'm sure. You know, Dennis, growing up when you did and where you did and when you did influence has a massive influence on your writing, your outlook, your philosophy, everything.
Yeah.
If you grew up in Boston 20 years, you know, in 1994, you'd have a different life.
It would be totally different. Yeah, no, it would be completely different. And I think I've always found the Marion Barry thing, you know, the reaction against Marion Barry to me is so clearly racist, particularly if it comes from Irish people, because in Boston, we had James Michael Curley. He was the first Marion Barry. He was the Rascal King. He was actually voted in after doing prison time.
Right.
So, I mean, he was corrupt as hell, but he looked out for his people. So his
take care of my people.
Hey, you're my guy. You know? So I find it, you know, I find guys like that absolutely fit, you know, because I just find them wonderful and fascinating. And their type of corruption is to me the type of corruption I can deal with.
Well, it also speaks to the complexity. We were talking earlier about human nature, but it speaks to the complexity of human nature, which is a great segue to this fabulous book, Small Mercies. And Dennis, I spend a lot of my life on planes. I've read every one of your books, and we could go on ad nauseum about Mystic River. We could go about, you know, books have been turned into movies. You know, these rock star directors that wanted to make your books into movies, people like Scorsese, like Ben Affleck, like Clint Eastwood. But I really want to spend some time on the book because it's so fabulous. But I think 14 books total for you so far,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, this is 14. 14? This is 14, yeah.
What took so long for you to write Small Mercies and just jump right in and tell us about Mary Pat, who is incredibly complex.
Incredibly complex. So, So I couldn't write for 4 years. I couldn't write prose. I could write scripts, but I couldn't write prose. I can't tell you why. And this was a reasonably, you know, tranquil time. I was, you know, the COVID hit. That's that a lot of people wrote during COVID.
Sure. But,
and I was building a television show, but I've built television shows before, you know, and then, but I'd never run a TV show from soup to nuts. So I moved my entire life down to New Orleans at the height of COVID. And we have several potentially lethal COVID outbreaks. I'm running a TV show for the first time. I am trying to hold it together with ungodly heat. Like
hurricane, right? Wasn't there a hurricane in the midst of it?
There was a hurricane near the end. Yep. Yeah. Almost daily. By that point, Taryn, my star, he was like, what's next, mate? Locusts. You know, we had personality clashes. We had a lot of things go wrong. We went over budget. We went over schedule. And in the midst of all of that, I started writing Small Mercies. So it's like 4 years of peace and tranquility, nothing. Total chaos. I'm writing away. And I think part of it is because that's where writing has always been a refuge for me. I bifurcate my brain. And so it's like all of a sudden I'm like dealing with craziness over here. And I'm like, I need something. I need an outlet. And that outlet became this book. And Mary Pat had been around in my head for a long time. I grew up with a lot of women like her. I knew a lot of Mary Pats. And I wanted to write a book in which a woman can, you know, completely with complete believability kicks the shit out of a man. Like I wanted you to buy it. And I had this image in my head of her as like this little, like a cross between like a lollipop kid from the Wizard of Oz and a roller derby athlete. Like it was just the two of them together, you know?
Sure.
And I just saw her as this just coming right at you type of person. And then I thought, what happens if you take everything that type of person has? What's going to happen? You better start praying was kind of what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. So I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to set that woman loose in the run up to the desegregation of the Boston public schools? What would that look? Because I've been wanting to tell that story about the summer of 74 into 75. I didn't get to 75 in this book, and I'm great with that. But I wanted to tell that story for at least 15 years. I remember Ben Affleck and I talking about it on the set of Gone Baby Gone. So that puts it at like 2007.
Yeah.
And how the story of Boston is a story of Boston. If you don't understand Boston, you can't understand Boston.
Yeah. And he would relate to that, of course.
Totally. Yeah. Totally.
Ben Affleck would. Okay. But give us I hate to do this to you, but give us the CNN headlines version of Mary Pat and what she's going through without obviously giving away too much at the end.
Mary Pat has a daughter who is on the verge of being bused from South Boston High School to Roxbury High School, which is how they decided to do it. They took the high school in the most historically white neighborhood in the city, and they took the high school in the most historically black neighborhood in the city, and they said, we're going to switch like 50% of the population, and you got 90 days to prepare. And the horrible part of all of this was that this desegregation had to happen, and it had to happen right then and right there. There was no question about it. It was justice delayed for far too long. But at the 11th hour, it was supposed to be a countywide experiment. It was supposed to happen in Suffolk County and in Middlesex County. And at the last second, the people in the NIMBY neighborhoods in the rich, white, mostly liberal suburbs pulled out of the deal. They pulled out and they said, make this. They dumped this on poor Judge Garrity, you know, who became the most vilified judge in the history of the city. And they said, it's only going to affect the city. And he said, you mean it's only going to affect the poor? And they were like, it's only going to affect the city. And so they dumped it on the city. And so Mary Pat begins the book feeling as if she's outraged at once again being told by the powers that be how she's going to live. And little voices in her head say, well, would you feel this way if you were, say, swapping with the Italian high school across in Revere? And she says, yeah, sure, I would. And she brushes it away and she brushes it away. So she's a racist who doesn't know the depths of her racism at this point. And her daughter goes missing. She's lost a son who came back from Vietnam to heroin. Her first husband was legally declared dead sometime in the 1960s. Her second husband has left her because of her hate, which she doesn't understand. She doesn't grasp that. And now she's trying to find her daughter, and nobody is helping, and nobody is lifting a finger. And she can't go to the police because in South Boston in 1974, you couldn't go to the police.
And there were still gangs that really ran neighborhoods. Okay, I promise you, Dennis, I'm going to do a question, then David, and then I'm going to turn it over in this order, Tope, I promise. Angie, and then you. They'll do the smart people questions. So again, without giving too much away, Mary Pat is a very complicated character.
Yes.
And one of the things I found myself doing as I was reading this book is going, oh my God, how could she say that? How could she think that? It's like, you know, sometimes when I'm watching something on TV, it's so awkward or uncomfortable, I want to change the channel.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then you find yourself rooting for her because she's driven by the passion that only a mother can understand. What is it like? I can't remember how long it took you to write this book, but it's been with you for many years.
Yeah.
Is it hard to get that close to a character like that for you?
No, not at all. No, I know so many Mary Pat.
Look at him. Wait, people can't see this on a podcast. He's smiling, this really scary smile.
I know so many Mary Pats. I know this is, it was very easy for me to get into her skin. I know these type of people. I grew up with these type of people. I get her to the core. And she has two journeys in this book. One is the heroic and practical one, which is find out what happened to her dog, right? And that is a mythic quest. And that is truly something that is
all in.
She is a hero in that journey.
Yeah.
Her other journey is an emotional and psychological journey. And that is not a heroic journey, in which she understands eventually and quite unwillingly through until the very end.
Yeah.
She's a racist, and that she has sent out, as one African-American character says to her, you raise these kids like little hand grenades and then you send them out into the world and you act like you have no connection to that. You act like it's not your fault. And I left it there. I didn't give any, you know, there's no hugging and there's no learning at the end of this book in terms of the white and the black characters. And I felt that that was authentic and honest. It's, you know, she shouldn't be let off the hook. And I felt like her journey in that regard was to see that her legacy, what she has passed on, is hate.
Yeah.
And people are hurt.
To that point. Okay. I'm Dave. I swear I'm coming to you. The book could have been called Unforgiven. Nobody's forgiven in this.
Oh, I don't know. No, I think some are. I think there's hopeful stories. I think Bobby's story is hopeful. I think Bobby and Carmen's story is hopeful. I think that in the end, the people who do have the beer, the black and white, no, they don't have beer, they won't be served. But Calliope and Ken Fenn, Ken Fenn's white, Calliope's African-American, they in the end have, there's hope for them. There's a little bit of hope there. But he was already moving down the journey in the right direction by the time he connected with her.
Yeah. So. Sequel. Okay, David.
I wanted to ask you how much your experience growing up impacted how you wrote for The Wire. Because that's a very different city.
Very different city. People. Okay, so here's
the thing. But there's a pathology there too, right?
Right. So we would write to... The Wire scripts were a little bit Frankenstein-y, you know? So what would happen is we'd get to the political stuff, and we knew we had Bill Zorzi to handle all the political stuff because that was his beat for years for the Baltimore Sun, right? So we would just go political stuff, blah, 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 blah. And that's what the script would say. And then Bill would take it, right? And the West Baltimore stuff was we'd just be like, you know, West Baltimore, East Baltimore, whatever Baltimore. We'd be like, all right, we're heading down, blah, blah, blah. And we're going to go meet at blah, blah, blah. And then Ed and David would come in and fix all that stuff. So George knew his stuff because he's from Silver Springs. But me and Richard Price, we didn't know shit, guys. We didn't, you know, we just, whatever. Like what we know is cities. And we know how cities work. And we know how the working class thinks, I think. And so that was it. That's how, you know. The irony of the Wire for years was always people would come up and they would say to me, oh, I love that episode you wrote. I love this line. And then they would quote me a line and I'd be like, yeah, I didn't write that. Yeah. I didn't write that. That was Richard's line. That was Bill Zorzi. You know, and then Richard would say the same thing. And we just didn't have any ego about the show. So it was just like, you know, if some of your scenes got moved into somebody else's episode and vice versa, it's fine. It was all, we were all part of a bigger thing.
Okay.
Rising tide. Rising tide. Angie?
You know, I was thinking about this. I was thinking, you know, you've written really strong women before. Like, you know, for example, Annabeth in Mystic River is very strong. Oh, I feel like she's kind of like Mary Pat, but we never saw heard this story from her perspective. We heard it from Celeste. Yeah. We heard it from Katie. Okay, this is how geeky I am. Can I just confess this to you guys? All right. So I actually did like a POV analysis of Mystic Rivers. I know that 10% the prose is from Celeste and 3% are from Katie. I just looked up my notes because I actually have. Okay. Now you're
highly
like.
Nerdy.
I'm sorry. I
shouldn't have told you. Angie wins the Geeking Out Award.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, at least I
love it.
Okay. So anyway. What I love about this is that at least 3/4, like 80% or something like that of this novel is from we're in Mary Pat's head.
Yeah, you're in Mary Pat. Yep.
You know, and so she's not just strong emotionally like somebody. I feel like Celeste was pretty and Annabeth was definitely strong emotionally, but physically not. And so, you know, it's not just her, like there are other female characters in this novel. There's rage churning and there's, you know, physical violence. That's delicious, I think. And I wondered, like, did you make her the protagonist of this novel, a woman on purpose? Or was it just this, what you said before about her being in your head and you knowing people like that? Because it occurs to me that this book is so much about, you know, parenting sacrifice, what we teach our children, guilt, responsibility for how our children turn out, what happens to them. And no offense to the dads, including my own husband, who may or may not be listening to this because he's a huge David Aldridge fan. But I think motherhood is a little more than fatherhood, right? Like synonymous with kind of the extremes of parenting sacrifice and these expectations of saintliness and all that. And so it makes sense to me that a story emphasizing that be told from a mother's perspective. And so I guess I wanted to know, like, did you pick her and did you say this should be a mother rather than a father?
Yeah. Oh, it was never a dad. There was never even a consideration. It was always a woman. It was always Mary Pat's a name I've used actually before. Someone pointed out it's the wife and I love that name. It's so Southie.
Right.
So Southie. Right. There was even a riff that I ended up cutting about how when I was growing up, there was Mary Jo's and Mary Pat's and Mary Frances's. And there was a point where all the Marys ended up in one room together. And then it was just like, that's why they go by these middle names. Because it was so many people of that generation named Mary.
Yeah. Okay. So why did you cut that? I would love that riff.
Like, I don't know what happened to that riff. But there was originally a meeting of the Schwab sisters. We saw them much earlier in the book. And they just killed the momentum. It killed the momentum. The book is a bullet. It's meant to be a bullet. Yeah, it's meant to take off and go. So that's why that was cut. But yeah, I guess I never saw it as anybody but her. I never saw the story as anything but the surprise of the book was Bobby. The surprise was Bobby walks into the book. He's supposed to walk out of the book.
Right.
And then he came back in. And it was at the exact right time because the book had by that point reached such a pitch of grief and darkness that I needed something to leaven it. And it became Bobby. And I was like, I need a hopeful character. I need a character who's going to hit a hopeful swing in their life. I need a character who's going to go up. And then I got to put him in a house that I've been trying to put into my books now for almost 20 years, which is, I can say this because it's a complimentary portrayal. His sisters are based on cousins of mine and they all live together in this big ramshackle house their entire lives. And I thought, what if Bobby lived with them and wouldn't that be a fun story? And so I did. And I got
it's a great scene. It's a great visual. It's a great
visual. I love that family. So I put them in.
Dennis, do you, Do you think that you did something? Do you think that you wrote anything differently because she's your main character is a woman? Like when you were, I mean, of course you've written, you know, from a female POV before, but did you sort of like think to yourself, like, I have to think of a particular woman or, you know, like things like that? No,
no, you got to understand, these women were all around when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And they all, you know, they had snap purses for their cigarettes and they were all just, they walked with their shoulders and you'd steer clear of them. And like, the story I always tell is we grew up in Dorchester, and Dorchester, where my neighborhood in particular is one of the more violent in the city. We're like, we all say Dorchester, where the murders come from. Well, 73% of all homicides come out of Dorchester. Oh, so, so we were a rough neighborhood, but Southie was like another world. And they raised them in a totally different way over there. So a friend of mine got the shit kicked out of him by three Southie girls on a platform, subway platform. And there was no shame to it. Like, none of us were like, oh, you got beat up by girls. We were all like, man, I would have run. You know what I mean? Like, they were a different breed over there. And so that's what Mary Pat's from. That's her world.
I can promise you people, there's not a single person in LA who could tell you what a snap purse is. And Dennis Lehane just talked about a snap purse because that's what those ladies all had.
Yeah, they all these little snappers. Had
those snappers. It's great. Chopi, what have you got?
My mind is snagged on a detail that you offered before about like that period of time when you could not write prose when you were writing screenplays instead. So I wonder about your identity as a writer. How do you see yourself? Do you see yourself as just a writer or as a writer of novels, of screen, like what is your identity as a writer?
Oh no, that's all gone now. I mean, now it's like anything. I did see myself for years as just a writer, but now that I've run a show and I was surprisingly, like, I was shocked that I was good at it because I never wanted to be a leader. I don't have a micromanaging bone in my body. Like, I really don't. And I thought I'm going to be terrible at this, but it actually turned out pretty well. So I was like, well, I enjoy this. I mean, we're set to go off and do another one in 2 months. We go into pre-production. So here's what I would put it as. I don't see myself as a writer anymore specifically. I see myself as a storyteller once and always. That's it. And whatever I can do to tell that story, you want to put a camera in my hand, that's great. Put a paintbrush, probably not a good idea because I can't draw to save my life. But you give me something that I can tell a story with, and that's all I want to do. That's it. And so that's it.
We're running out of time. Let's get you out with this. You can pick these two questions.
Okay.
My gut tells me, based on our longstanding close personal relationship here, that you really needed to write this book, Small Mercies. So you can answer this question. What did you learn about yourself writing Small Mercies, or how has having daughters changed how you write?
I would say having daughters has changed a lot of things. It's forced me to be in a routine in a very different way than I used to. Uh-huh. It's forced me to be more present. So that's why I lean more towards screenwriting.
Sure.
Give me more of a tunnel vision. It's also made me remove this veneer I used to have of sort of, I don't know, civility about certain things or of being civilized about certain things. I have daughters. Anybody who hurts a woman, I'd put two in their head and not even blink. I'd feed them to dogs. I have no problem with it. And I don't pretend anymore on that one. Like, I just don't. Like, my daughter and I watch horror movies on Saturday mornings because, you know, so she doesn't get nightmares. And we watched Black Phone. And at the end of Black Phone, he's got one up on the bad guy, you know? And he can run or he can finish the job. And spoiler alert, the kid finishes the job. And I turned to my daughter and I said, if you're ever in this circumstance, you do that. You kill, kill, kill. You know what I mean? Ever. You don't give him a second chance to get to you. And she was like, okay, dad. And I'm like, that's what's changed. That is Mary Pat in this book is 100%. There's not a single thing she does in her quest for vengeance that I got even a tiny bit of moral problem with.
Yeah. Hell bent. It just kept coming up to me, Mary Pat. Yep. Okay. The book is Small Mercies. It's easy for me to say, Dennis Lehane, but I think it's the best ever.
Thank you.
Like, it's the best ever. It seems the most important, the most personal to you, which I think is terrific. So thank you for joining us so much.
These were great questions.
Thank you.
Thank you for everything.
Come back with whatever the next project is. I'm going to talk to these guys for a little bit, but thank you so much.
Talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah. All right.
Bye. So much.
See ya. Take care.
Pleasure. Big time star. I like that. We had a star on the show today.
So great. So great. There were 9 million other things I wanted to ask him about. Oh my God.
I wanted to know if Scorsese actually talks that fast.
Well, okay. I tried to figure this out, but Scorsese, Eastwood, Affleck, who else? What's the other one?
You said Eastwood, right?
Eastwood, Affleck, Scorsese. There's another famous one. Directors who came to him and said, I want to do your book. And most of the times he turned them down. I don't think there's another writer that has had those kind of powerhouse directors.
No. I don't know. I guess a lot of Ken Follett stuff's been made into movies, right? But not at that level, right? Not by those kinds of directors.
Which tells you something. And I wanted to hear from him why he thought, what was it they see in his work that they incredible. It's great. Okay, Angie, tell us about the book coming out in September. Tell us what happened.
What? We're talking about that now? What?
We are.
No, there's so much more I want to talk about with like what we just went through.
We'll get it back. Based on the interviews I've watched that he does a lot of interviews, God bless him. Based on the ones I've watched in the last couple of years, that's the most fun he's had in a long time. So I think we'll come back.
Oh, good. Yeah, we'll get it back. All right. Yeah. Well, all right.
Tell us about Happiness Falls.
Oh, all right. Happiness Falls, elevator pitch. It's about a biracial family that's thrown into crisis when the father goes missing. His teenage son is the only one who might know what happened, but he cannot speak because he has Angelman syndrome, a very rare genetic condition. So the headstrong daughter who's home from college is the narrator, the Korean immigrant mom, the whole family really has to come together to find the father and also to protect the son, who can't speak, from the police, who are, you know, not very understanding, obviously. Mm-hmm. So it's like a family drama, mystery. Where's the father? What happened to him? And, you know, and all of that comes together. But I really do think that it's, you know, the questions of race, justice, family loyalty, sacrifice, you know, communication. How do we connect with each other? So
those
are the things I'm hoping. Yep.
You will be back in September. We haven't scheduled it yet.
Of course I will. Always.
Okay, a little bit of housekeeping, everybody. May 20th, Gaithersburg Book Festival. By the way, Mayor Judd Ashman, our favorite mayor, Gaithersburg was just named the most diverse city.
Nice.
What?
Yeah, really? It was named the most diverse city.
In the country?
I believe so.
We'll have to
talk to him about it. But I think, Toby, you've been to the Gaithersburg Book Festival, right? Angie, I know you have.
I haven't been. Almost went one time, but I haven't been. No.
Okay. We'll get you there. It's fabulous. It's absolutely fabulous. Literally hundreds of authors, events, kids stuff, poetry slams. It's really pretty remarkable. And I think it really is becoming one of the most important book festivals out there. David, I hope David can join us on May 20th. And we're going to do a Teresa.
I'll make sure I get there.
Okay. Sure. This time I think it's early afternoon.
I'm going to be there the same time. So I'm going to come see you guys. Yeah. I'll heckle you from
here. Good. Heckle. Lou will be there. Who else? Nevin Martell is moderating something. We've got several people, but it's fabulous. So we encourage people to come out there on May 20th. Free parking, free admission, all those kinds of things. I had so many other things. You guys have to come back. David, thank you. Angie, thank you. Tope, thank you so much. Lauren Larson, thank you so much. Everybody, go out and buy Small Mercies and get ready to buy Angie's book in September. Thanks, guys. Yay.